Jaya Jaya. Gopala Jaya Jaya.
Hey, stranger.
Radha Ramana Hari. Govinda Jaya Jaya. Sounds like this. Govinda Jaya Jaya. Gopala Jaya.
Of Krishna's names. Govinda, go in Sanskrit has various meanings. Go can mean the senses, go can mean the land, go also means cows. So Krishna or Govinda is he who gives pleasure to the senses, to the cows, to the land. Jaya is an invocation of joy. Like when I see Tamar, I go, Jai Tamar. It comes right out. I'm just Govinda Jaya Jaya Gopala, another name of Krishna, Gopala, the cowherd boy. The pastoral life in Krishna's village is surrounding the life of the cows and calves. So in particularly Krishna's childhood, he's taking care of the calves. They take them out to the fields every day to eat the fresh green grasses, and then they bring them home to their mothers at night. Gopala Jaya Jaya. Radha Ramana. The joy of Radha. Radha being the principal gopi or cowherd girl in the village of Vrindavan. And that divine love affair that you see embodied in the image that we keep on our altar of Radha and Krishna. The yin, the yang, the male, the female. The Shakti and the Shaktiman, the two forces of creation that constitute love. A simpler way would simply be to say lover and beloved. Radha Ramana, the joy of Radha, Govinda Jaya Jaya. So we start with a little chant just to kind of get ourselves out of that stressed out New York, Midtown, you know, workaday thing, create a new space for ourselves. And we're in the... Anybody new here?
We have some books scattered and not everybody has books.
Not everyone has books. So if you wanted, when we chant this, we're going to be chanting the fourth verse of the fourth chapter. So you might just maybe sit next to someone who doesn't have a book. In this fourth verse, and I know some of you have to leave early, so I'm going to get to this film clip sooner rather than later. And then we'll go into the verse and discussions. I want to acknowledge a few people here. My dear friend Vivian is here with us today. Vivian, hello. Thank you for coming. I had the great pleasure of meeting Vivian, about a year ago, was it? at the 40th anniversary gathering of the Mabu Minds Theater Company here in New York. And you don't mind if I introduce you to the lads and lassies. Vivian is on the board of Film Forum and was there as a friend of Mabu Minds. And we just kind of like, you know, started yakking like magpies. And it's been wonderful. Vivian is an extraordinary artist. You can close your ears if this makes you uncomfortable. But if you go to her website, is it vivianbauer.com? You'll see some absolutely breathtaking work. And so I'm just delighted that Vivian is with us, especially since this film today just happens to work out. This is a rather poetic and artistic piece of work by a fellow named Louis Schwartzberg. Now, if you wanted to see some of Louis's work, you can just go to YouTube. He is a preeminent nature cinematographer. We tried to play a clip of him from the TED conference lineup, and we couldn't get a signal, I think, in the room or something. But for those of you out in, you know, podcast land, hello. If you wanted to, you're not going to get to see this, but if you go to Louis Schwartzberg on YouTube or on the TED conference site, you'll see some of his extraordinary work. And the reason why I thought it was appropriate for this particular verse is that we're at a place in the Gita where Arjuna is totally befuddled about how to reconcile the large and the small. He's saying in essence, and we'll chant this verse after the film clip, I don't get it. I don't get it, he says to Krishna. You're talking about yourself as though you are from some cosmic space, that you are older than old, that what you're telling me, you told Vivasvan, the sun god, at the dawn of creation. Now, you and I grew up together. We're buddies. I'm married to your sister. What on earth are you talking about? How do I incorporate this idea of you into what I know of you? And don't we all face that to some extent? We deal with the specificity of our lives, and yet at the same time, this easy commerce we have with the vastness of cosmic consciousness. The idea of being a part of some extraordinary, breathtaking, larger picture of things. And that's a real problem. It's a real problem. Because where do you go with that? It's absolutely unreconcilable. You're in your yoga moment, right? We're in our Gita moment here. And it feels so absolutely right. So, yes. So now, to quote E. Cummings. So yes. So now. And then we walk outside and whoop, we're back into that groove of doing that. So to somehow maintain that sense of this there, how do we do that? And is it possible? Could you do that? I mean, can you get through your day living in a state of ecstasy? I'm not sure anything. You'd never get your groceries bought. You know? How can you do your laundry if you're in that space? So there's that sense of having to reconcile the vastly large and the minutely small. And our life being constantly in the balance of those things, on the fulcrum of the large and the small all the time. You never walk down the street and see a homeless person and say, how can I go have dinner? You know, I'm on my way to dinner, and here's someone without food. What do I do with this moment? Or you think of some of the many challenging situations in the world and say, all right, now how do I encompass this? How do I find some kind of balance between the privilege of my life and what I see around all the time? So we're always going back and forth. Anyway, Louis deals with this in his films. And he's done a rather lovely job of finding a way of articulating how the large and the small live together. And that's why I wanted you to see this. We're going to see about a half hour of this, okay? And it's absolutely breathtaking. Let me just read you a little bit from what he says of it. This film is not released yet, by the way. This is an illegal screener. I got it because we're doing some work together, and he let me have it. And so it's we didn't publicize this too broadly. You can see a little of this on the TED conference, but you guys are getting to see something that others have not seen yet. It's called Hidden Beauty. And I'll just read you a little bit. Environmental issues pose a global concern. It's our generation's responsibility to inform one another and act before it is too late. The little-known story of pollinators must be shared in order to remedy the situation. And then jumping down farther, Hidden Beauty launches into the stories of selected animal characters. A bat, a hummingbird, a butterfly, bumblebee, and honeybee. Their tales reveal the extraordinary importance of flowers and their pollinator partners, as well as hidden worlds of intrigue and drama, of sporadic violence, mesmerizing beauty that continually play out around us, but that we seldom notice. Peering into these diminutive realms, using special cinematic techniques, we discover and examine the boundless diversity and creativity of the forces of life on Earth, and this critical moment in which we find ourselves responsible to sustain that which has been sustaining us. So some of this may seem familiar to you, and I'm tragically sad that we cannot see this in high definition. I mean, the way to see this is on a Blu-ray screen with a Blu-ray player, you know, because it is utterly, utterly breathtaking. But I think you'll get the idea, even with our humble little setup here. So would you pass that back to Michael, and we'll pause recording while we screen this. Okay. Before we get started, is everybody okay?
We're pausing recording.
I know some of you have to go. Live with the shame of that for the rest of your days, if you must. And I think rather than just me up here pontificating, I would love to hear what some of your thoughts are on what we've just seen. What are the parts that struck you the most? What stuck out for you and why? Just any feedback at all? Any thoughts about what we've just seen? Let's start with Sam. What's that? For that reference. Good. So things are being done. Any other thoughts or reflections?
Well, as a real estate developer, one of the things I always work on with the people I work with as investors is trying to clean the roofs. I think it's a no-brainer project that everybody's house had green roofs.
Green roofs, is that what you're saying?
Yes. There's no reason why everyone doesn't have these kind of solid roof in this entire country. And I think that would help dramatically change the consumption of energy, move in, it lowers energy costs, and it proves that it lowers climates because of the lack of gas in the air. Mm-hmm. And then, so this is one of my thoughts. This is reinforcing. Imagine a city with all green roofs.
Green roofs. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I found it interesting that it was told in perspective of the bumblebee and the nature of flowers. You know, we're so used to being the actor, the author, first person narrator. And I think it was pleasantly surprising to have that. And it reminded me of the focus of my character with Stila Sukha Asana, your relationship to the earth should be steady and joyful in a mutually beneficial way. And I think that at certain points in the documentary, it was nice how it reinforced that mutually beneficial relationship to the human and Mother Nature.
Okay.
It can coexist. It doesn't have to be so off balance.
Mm-hmm. All right, so nice. We're starting to make some connections with yoga. Lovely. Other thoughts? Yeah, John?
I'm always fascinated when I see these things about the innate natural intelligence that exists, you know, with these creatures. And I think specifically with the butterfly, just understanding what kind of leaf to use because it has certain toxins that will keep predators away. The babies, you know, coming out instinctively understanding what they need to do. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, I think it's so amazing because something we can be closed-minded about our level, our intelligence, not even really appreciating just how incredibly intelligent other forms of life can be on this planet.
Intelligent. Other adjectives that come to mind to describe the phenomena that we've been looking at? Found it extraordinarily elegant as well. There's an artistic flair to the way these things happen that escapes our attention because it often is on such small scales that we neglect it. We don't see it. It's there, but we don't see it.
Very delicate.
Delicate. Mm-hmm. Other adjectives that come to mind?
Respectful.
Respectful. Okay.
Well, in the sense that there was the feeling of respectfulness, but it wasn't a preaching film. It wasn't saying you humans are bad and you're making things bad. It was treated as though we're all related and we all have that same innate.
You're talking now about Louis,
how
the film was done.
Yeah.
Okay. Michael, when you said respectful,
when
you said delicate, did you mean that it's a delicate balance or delicate in the sense of aesthetically delicate?
I think there is a delicate balance. Like is coming back in the next 3 to 5 years, supposedly, because of the depletion of the soil nitrates in the world. Mm-hmm. And that is a balance to rebalance nature that's off balance right now due to overfarming and overpopulation. Mm-hmm. And we will have food shortage, and it's a very delicate balance that the world is. I mean, not just in nature, just in terms of how we live. You know, it's very simple that, you know, we take for granted that we have laws and we're able, you know, I know I can walk on the street and be safe. It's very easy for a situation to happen where chaos can ensure people.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably rambling a little bit right now.
No, I think your point's well made that we sometimes kind of run roughshod over a natural order that really requires a more nuanced respect for the balance of things. And we went through this in the last chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna talks about this relationship, this agreement that was started at the dawn of time, that there would be this reciprocity with nature, provided we respect nature. And that as long as we did our share, nature would do her share. That's something that's been there. That's a divine plan, that balance of things.
Okay. I also look at it as a delicate balance in terms of spirituality.
Mm-hmm. Tell us what that means.
I think, as a person living in the material world, you continue down your spiritual intellectual, you lose touch with the emotional part of your spiritual practice. So if you come too knowledgeable of the Bhagavad Gita, but you don't live the Bhagavad Gita, you are up here in terms of knowledge.
what these methods are, then you're going to move nowhere in life. You're not going to move forward and get closer to Krishna consciousness. Mm-hmm.
Lovely. Thank you.
I think I agree with that, but also I think it's like vibration. These are very, this is just way out there because I've never read anything about it. I just feel it in my heart. But it's about vibration. When each individual has a vibration of pure love, regardless of whatever you've read or anything, but that love, that's what brought Daniel to the lion's den, and the lions didn't kill him. And I think that these are picking up on love.
Yeah, that was a very troubling part of this, wasn't it? That somehow they're gone. Why, we don't know. And the havoc that that can create if we don't figure out what it is that we may have done to disrupt that harmonious relationship. Yeah, yeah.
I got from the video us humans can mess things up quickly, but at the same time fix it. If we come to that understanding that it needs to be fixed, and enough people need to fix it. Like in the beginning, they were talking about the bees dying, and there's no more flowers, and the pollination not being there, but then humans. Certain people are starting to be aware of that and
face
the problem.
Yeah.
That takes the whole world.
Yeah. That was, I think, an important contribution to the storyboard of this film, that there was that beat that brought us out of this, you know. Meryl, did everyone recognize Meryl Streep as the narrator voice there?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I mean, she's played a lot of parts, including now a queen. I don't know if she's ever played a flower before. But I think she did a lovely job. It was a very delicate interpretation of that that narrator voice. And it was balanced by what Casey's talking about. Casey, yes? Namely, that there are things that can be done. So there's that kind of practical side that that Sam was referring to, that there are simple things that we might do if we're aware of it. Any other thoughts? Because then I'm going to give you some of my own. I've also had some very strong reactions to what we've seen here. Yeah.
You asked for an adjective. I think intricate. It's to my mind, and just the tiny details of the monarch alone and all these little steps and how that ties in to the plants and then moved on to the bees. And it's awe-inspiring, these intricacies. And it made me think of scientists talk about new farming methods and they attempt to study ramifications of practices before they implement them. But seeing how awesome it is, I just think it's so naive and arrogant to think you could possibly see the ramifications of some of, a really glaring example is like genetic engineering. To think you could possibly see what is going to happen. It's just like naive, I guess, the only word that comes to mind. And I think with the stakes so high, the only humble thing to do is maybe to sort of mimic, like this biomimicry, but not to attempt to intervene in some way.
What a fascinating distinction. Thank you. Thank you for that. That's provocative. The idea that we might be able to go about the work of repairing and understanding and enhancing production and so on without disrupting the natural order of that.
It reminds me a little bit, too, of what the teacher David says about, like,
You put me in mind of one of the tenets of the Gita, which we'll be studying later on. I think it's in the 9th chapter, so that means around 2026 we'll be getting to that. There's a distinction made between savoring art and possessing art. The Gita exhorts us to take our satisfaction in the appreciation of something without crossing the line into the coveting of the thing that we appreciate. It's a fine line that you really have to kind of study yourself very carefully, because the line is different at a different place for each of us, between being able to live in an appreciation of art, an aesthetic environment, and one where we feel that to be fulfilled we must own that thing that we appreciate. Let me feed back a little bit of my own reactions to this, if I may. First of all, I found myself getting a little emotional when the butterfly thing was happening. That image, and I think the narration even mentions it, that in human discourse, we take this transformation of the caterpillar into a butterfly as emblematic of our progress in life. And that was such a dramatic change. I mean, such a dramatic change. And yet it was the same entity. The same entity inhabiting that caterpillar form, which then becomes something so vastly different from what it was previously. And is that not really what our spiritual practice calls us to do? Sounds rather corny, but, you know, to become butterflies from caterpillars, to somehow move forward from the dependent creatures we have been to creatures who can fly. I mean, it's literally a sense of becoming from a ground animal to an air animal. You can move into that greater space and look so beautiful at the same time. And it's just amazing. So that for me was one important moment. And the other thing that I found myself really kind of getting hit by here is the bees dying. And I'll bet everybody here, I see you, I'll call you in a minute. I bet everybody here knows somebody who's dying because they've lost contact with that greater mystery of what's happening around us. And I think that's what this verse in the... Instead of taking the time to chant the verse this week, we'll catch up next week on chanting. Arjuna is saying, I don't understand the connection. I need help making this connection between you as this divine, all-knowing being. You representing what I could become should I enter into that mystery. And the you I know in the everyday worldly sense. And I think that's a risk. That's a risk that we all run, is to lose that. Prabhupada, my teacher, used to call it the Krishna sensation. He said if you cut on your fingernail, you don't feel it. There's no sensation there. Half an inch lower on the skin, you feel that. And so it's a little bit like that, going from the hardness of the nail to the sensitivity of the skin. He called it the Krishna sensation. The same world we see every day, but with a different vision of it. Something that becomes inspiring. That hit me in this film. And not wanting to go back. Because I remember what it was like before entering an ashram. I remember what my life was like. And then I remember my life in the ashram. And now I know my life since I've left the ashram. And I look at those different stages, and I don't want to lose that enthusiasm ever. Ever. I don't want to. I don't want to come back to that place where life is just okay. That's my nightmare. My nightmare, you know, everyone has something that, you know, causes you sleepless nights. My nightmare is somehow losing that Krishna sensation, going back to a place where life's okay. Life's not okay. I don't want it to be okay. I want to continue on with this sense of being on the edge all the time, that I can stay awake somehow to this, to the miracles that are surrounding us at every moment that we overlook because we can't see them. We're not looking for them. Our senses are too blunt to perceive them, and yet they're there. Maybe Vivian can tell us about it. I think that's the vision of the artist, is to live like that. You're seeing things that other people don't see. My brother's a mathematician and a physicist. He looks at the world. I can't imagine what he's seeing. I just can't imagine how he understands the various multi-dimensions of reality and how that's different from how I see. I remember our dad, who was a voice teacher. I think I told you this story once. I went to see him back in the 80s, I guess it was, when the first broadcast of Pavarotti on public television was happening. Walked in, he's sitting there weeping copiously. I'm like, Dad, what's the matter? He's like, what happened? He said, he pointed to the television. He said, the control. Like then there's Pavarotti just, you know, belting it out with this instrument of magnificence. And I'm listening. I'm not hearing what he's hearing because I wasn't a voice teacher. I wasn't a songwriter. I don't hear with his ears. I'm not hearing it. I'm not seeing with the eyes of an artist or with the mind of a physicist. So I'm denied a certain privilege of deeper vision because I lack those tools. And I think that's what yoga is about. I think our yoga is meant to refine our tools so that what we cannot otherwise see is revealed. Not because we've become great yogis, but because through a sincere effort, that vision is revealed to us. And that's the Bhagavad Gita. That's the unique message of the Bhagavad Gita, is that we don't make spiritual progress. Spiritual progress is bestowed upon us when we achieve a degree of humility and the kind of position that Arjuna has, where Krishna says to him, this was the verse, I think, 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago, Bhaktosi me sakha chiti. Why am I telling you this? Because I love you and you love me. Because you won't betray me with this. I can confide this to you with confidence, knowing that you'll use this well, you'll use this properly. It's a great trust, that spiritual vision of things. Extraordinary, precious trust. That's very Gita, the idea that this is a family, that our relationship with nature is a familial relationship. You have a certain extra degree of respect and consideration. Please?
Can I tell a little story?
Yeah.
Many years ago, I was in Staten Island looking for a place to live, and I took a little break, and I found this little park. And I bought a sandwich and I found a rock in the middle of the park and I sat down. It was a nice summer day and I was just enjoying myself. And there were a bee came along, and I'm normally, at least at that time, I used to be afraid of bees. And a bee came along, and then I said to myself, why don't you choose not to be afraid and not to react and just let it be? And let it be, to be or not to be. And I was eating the sandwich, and the bee kept trying to get to the sandwich. And I said, oh, I see, you would like to have a piece of sandwich. And
And I said, okay, so I broke up a little bit of it, and there was a smaller rock next to my rock, and I put it there. And I said, you're welcome to share my sandwich, but your sandwich, but you would have to eat here, okay? And so the bee got it. And the bee went over to the little sandwich, and he played with it a little bit. And then he went away for a bit, and then he came back and brought a friend. And I just looked at them and I smiled. I said, thank you so much for hearing me. I'm so glad you're enjoying the sandwich. And the two bees had a great time eating their sandwich, and I had a great time eating mine. So we got to live in harmony together.
Nice story.
I think there's a movement of simpler times.
There is a?
I think there's a movement towards simpler times. In a sense, like, up until maybe the last 20 years, it was about more modernization, progress, 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 progress. And then we got to a point where we're like, well, what are we making this more junk? Yeah. Who cares? That's, you know, it's not making us happy. So, you know, maybe if we slow down and we, you know, learn to grow food and we learn to live a quieter life, maybe we'll get happier since all this junk that we keep making isn't going to happen.
In this clip that we just saw from Louis Schwartzberg's film, did anybody else have a little feeling of discomfort? When he was doing the nature stuff, the close-up, slow motion photography of the hummingbirds and the bees and, you know, I mean, that, and the monarch butterflies, my gosh, this magnificent. That was all very wonderful. Then when he comes to the part where he's talking about the greenhouse crops and so on, I'm trying to figure out what, you know, I wasn't comfortable with it. You know, now granted that this may be an efficient way of creating large crops and so on. And, you know, the narration made much of the fact that it's recycled water and, you know, no pollution and so on. But still, was anyone else uncomfortable with that?
Surprised.
Surprised? Is that the word? Why? Surprised how?
I think for the same reasons you feel that you're in true nature. You're in the absolute. And then you have this other thing that is all man-made. And it's all, you know, pointed out that it was very safe.
Right.
Yeah, nevertheless, it wasn't natural.
Yeah. And we're looking at trucks transporting the beehives to almond orchards, and there's just something about that I couldn't quite go along with it anymore at that point. I was losing some of my enthusiasm for it. Yeah.
So presumably when you have those very large greenhouses, you have to truck or ship in the bees, which the narration stated it puts the bees under stress, which then can lead to diminishing their number, which then sort of brings into question the idea of yield. So if you have the bee population diminishing, your yield of fresh produce is jeopardized. So it's sort of, you create the greenhouses because you want to secure a yield of a particular produce, but then you're putting one element of that cycle under stress, so you jeopardize the thing you're trying to create. So it's sort of self-perpetuating this sort of dangerous cycle. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with the discomfort.
You've studied this. I mean, you seem to really know something.
Yeah, I really like bees. I love humble bees. And like I say, it's been a discussion that's been going on in the UK for some time, and there are quite a few books and documentaries about bee colonies.
Yeah.
Apparently Australian bumblebees are doing pretty well. Because the idea being that bees have been sort of shipped from continent to continent, but Australia has quite tight import and export rules over its bee population, so they have been more protected from mites and parasites and such like. So we have to hope Australia's bees stay healthy for the good of all of nature.
Yes.
With the greenhouse.
Yeah.
And then it's like this big question that I thought was obvious. He asks, so why don't the bees come back?
Right. Yeah, it's not a perfect script.
And then it was like, yeah. And then it said, well, it's because we make it inhospitable with like fossil fuels, which I'm sure it's part of it, but mm-hmm. you just showed how the bee did this intricate dance of telling the other bees how you find the sun and how you get to that flower. Mm-hmm. So maybe they just all maybe the same bee communicated like, this is not hospitable. Why would you come back?
Yeah. Now, there were questions raised that demanded to be addressed, and they weren't addressed. I think it's one of the reasons why Disney is not releasing this film. Needs some work still. But, I'm glad that we had a chance to see as much as we did, because it's so magnificent. And this is just this crummy little system. I mean, if you see it in high def, it's utterly, utterly breathtaking stuff. I want to bring it back to the Gita. I want to bring it back to this first and the fourth chapter. And we've talked a little bit about the notion of dying if you're not connected to that greater mystery. I mean, you got to have water, you have to have some food, you have to have oxygen. I don't think we need sex to live, but I do think you need to have constant touch with divinity. I'm not sure how long we can survive if we don't have that in some form. If there isn't some constant nourishment, if our batteries aren't being spiritually charged somehow regularly with some contact with beauty, with this magnificent architecture, you know, that surrounds us, I don't know how long we can survive. Why is it, he said rhetorically, that so often it's easier for us to see that divinity in someone else and not in ourselves? Why is it that we can look at nature and see that? Why is it we can see some great work of art and we can acknowledge, you know, the inspiration, some divine touch there, and we have such a hard time finding it in ourselves?
Well, in nature, there's not so much pretense. Mm-hmm. It's easier to see it in nature because there isn't a lot of other facades going on. Mm-hmm. You know, we're playing so many different roles, and the people that we're in contact with are playing so many different roles. Mm-hmm. It kind of masks our ability to see the divinity because mm-hmm. we're so distracted by those roles.
Mm-hmm. We wear clothes.
Ooh. Okay.
We falsely think that we're separated from each other.
Think that we're not worth anything to be close to God. Mm-hmm. Like when we're born, when we're children, we see magic everywhere. Mm-hmm. And you know, you watch a little kid fly, and it's like amazing. Mm-hmm. And you know, you ask them, do you believe in God? And they're like, yes, of course I believe in God. God is real. Any kid, no matter if they're religious or not, believes in a superpower and higher power.
Yeah.
But as we get older, we start to get.
If you ever go to Krishna temples, the children are dancing in front of the deities like crazy. No problem. You know, I told you my mother's reaction, right? After came out of the ashram after 13 years, she says, the food was fine, the music is nice. What's with the dolls? What's with the dolls? What's with the dolls? I couldn't figure that one out. Anna, what were you saying? You said something. I want to say that again.
I said, what did you ask from the beginning? Why is it hard for us to see that in ourselves? But
yeah.
Because we think that we're separated from other beings.
That sense of separateness.
We're not. We're from the same source as
mm-hmm.
I'm from the same source.
But we're separate now. We see ourselves as separate.
Yes.
But we're so used to identifying with ourselves as the doer of this and that and the other thing and all the things we have to do and all the things that we have done.
So because we take responsibility for our actions, and we see ourselves as the ones who are responsible, and therefore we're defensive.
We see, by identifying ourselves as the doer, our ego maintains its separateness from
I said before their intelligence, and I wonder if what I meant is their sense of purpose. Not the two, not the same, synonymous, nor separate. But I think that's, and from what you're mentioning about, I admire their, I'm almost envious of their sense of purpose.
Whose sense of purpose?
Well, the bees, the butter, the butterfly, because they know exactly where they're supposed to go, they know kind of what they need. I would only feel that way if I had a part of myself that didn't know that or didn't understand that for myself. So I look at something else and I envy it. And I wonder if that's part of the two, spiritual practices about having a sense of purpose. And you can see it in them, but you can't see it yourself.
Rodney. Lovely. Casey?
I'm just thinking. We are all naturally servants of the Supreme Being. And because we're in the position of servant, and we're always looking at whatever it is that we're serving to serve others, and we're looking at ourselves as like humbler and putting ourselves in that position of serving when we're looking at the world, or we're looking at someone else we admire, we're looking at in the view of the position of the servant.
So are you saying that sense of ourselves as servants of a supreme being favors?
What I'm saying is that we don't look at ourselves as this amazing figure, or we venerate other people or other things or situations or bees or nature because we are we put ourselves in a position of serving that that we don't think of ourselves higher than that, and because this is God, this is nature, this is the divine order, and we are sort of humbled by that. Our position, and when we see it in someone else, and who has the character of godliness, we see that godliness in someone else, we just naturally become servant of that other person, and we forget about our own selves. Because that person is also a part and parcel of the divine.
And that's an inspiration for us to see that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why we don't see it in ourselves.
Well, I'm processing what you're saying in my own way, and saying that I sometimes look at very spiritually proficient people and think, gee, I don't know if I could live like that. I don't know what it would be like to live that spiritually all the time. And I, I just wonder if my feet would ever touch the ground, kind of thing. And how could I just get through the day? know, if I was like that, you know, is it, can you live that way with that kind of vision constantly and still be effective at what you have to do? That's one of the questions. I ask myself that question. As someone who's not very spiritually advanced, it's easy for me to ask that question, what would it be like to be like that? And then transposing that into the life I know, saying, I wonder, you know, could I live in a constant state of awe of this kind of miracle happening around me all the time, where every molecule, every atom, every small creature, insect, bird, bee, tree, flower, is an enlivenment because it is seeing Krishna there? What would that be like? You know, would my wife divorce me? I mean, what would happen? Would my kids say, enough already? You know, what would that be like? How would that change things for me? Yeah. Purnima.
Maybe I would offer that Krishna becoming manifest in the external senses. He gave us external senses to celebrate and to merge with oneness. I understand that in the bhakti path, to celebrate that reaching and longing for God, but ultimately understanding that merging, that all is one and all is God. And God comes in a myriad of forms. And so, in the spirit of being a servant, you can be there to serve in every aspect of every being. And one is not less than the other. And certainly, you are one of the many manifestations of Krishna.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. Yeah. You put me in mind of something that my teacher told me once many years ago, going back to 1973 maybe. I asked Prabhupada, what is art? What is art? And I thought he would say, well, art is, you know, a picture of Krishna. Or, I didn't know what he was going to say. And he surprised me. He said, art is the ability to place something in such a way that it is of utmost utility for others. I said, I'm not quite sure I understand that. And he said, yes, art means to place something, meaning I think to reveal something, in such a way that it is an inspiration to others. And I still wasn't quite sure what he was talking about. I said, well, you know, and remember, this is 1973. So there are some artists who take things out of their best place. Like Andy Warhol, you know, will take a soup can out of its natural place on the shelf and put it on a pedestal, and that'll be a work of art. He said, well, maybe for some people, that's a work of art. That was his response. He says, maybe you like it. He said, but beauty is a different thing. He said, you know, what is aesthetically pleasing is different. Art, at least from the Vaishnava perspective, from the devotional perspective, means that you're doing something with such care for its value for others that it becomes a source of inspiration. And he said, and in that sense, a sincere street sweeper is an artist. And then I said, oh, that struck me. That struck me. Art is not some aloof, restricted, reserved realm of, you know, the divinities, you know, that those with the inspiration can create art, and the rest of us mortals, we kind of get along with whatever we can do. The artistic life, I mean, this is, you know, it was Vivian who suggested I read a book by Michael Kimmelman that I would recommend to you called The Accidental Masterpiece. Small little book. Kimmelman, was the art critic for the New York Times. And in this book, Kimmelman talks about art as living in a state of constant heightened awareness to the artistry that surrounds us at every moment. And to my mind, that's what's happening in this Bhagavad Gita. That's what's happening in this particular verse of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is not asking Arjuna in some mechanical fashion, how do I reconcile growing up with you with the mathematics of you being at the dawn of time? That's not what's happening. Remember, dig deeper in these verses. Don't just read them on surface. Don't read them on face value. It's a big mistake. Big mistake. It's what the academics do. You know, they like study the Sanskrit, and what a terrible tragedy that is. Go deeper into what's going on, and you will find something absolutely extraordinary. And what Arjuna is asking about is, how do I lift myself? Remember the circumstances. He's on the edge of battle. He can't fight. He's traumatized. He describes himself in the second chapter as going through a nervous breakdown. He says, I've got a fever. My mind is reeling. I'm sweating. My palms are wet. I can't even stand up. I don't remember my name. I can't do anything. Please help me. He's absolutely traumatized. He's catatonic. He cannot do his job. He cannot do anything. He's not doing a mathematical calculation. How do we figure out that you did this? He's saying, how do I get out of this impasse? Help me to understand that deeper part of you, which I cannot see just by calculating that we grew up together. Help me to see that divinity that is within you. Help me to understand the divinity that is in the world around me. And help me to understand the divinity that is within me. That's the confusion. The confusion is lost sight of himself as a divine being. And I think a film like this is a nice reminder of what we're surrounded by. So when we leave here, let's try to maintain that sense of wonder over the tiny details of miracle that surround us all the time. It's always there. And we just kind of fall into a pattern. Yeah?
I'm going to go back to your use of the word savor. Because you used it before, that you want to savor things. And I think that that's a critical word. And it doesn't have to be on that magnificent scale. I think being able to be ordinary and savor the ordinariness of our lives is savoring, and it's being aware of the lake and the rock and the wave. I think when we start to elevate what can be, or make a hierarchy of savoring certain things and not savoring other things, we're sort of missing the point. I think just savoring as being is present. We use that word a lot. It's not so easy. But to just notice whatever you notice and just pay attention to it, and but savor it, taste it. Even if it doesn't taste good, you can just taste it. And then you're alive. Because there's a lot that doesn't taste good.
Vivi, would you say your teacher's name?
Zigar Kondro Rinpoche. I'm a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner.
Yeah.
And because of Joshua, I've been reading actually his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, and it's been so interesting for me, because of course they're the same and they're not quite the same. The basic ideas are they're all the same.
Yeah.
And I just want, this somehow this fits into the discussion about, this is again very personal. Except on the text that I was reading, there's an expression, no hindrance of mind. And that has echoed for me a lot, the idea of no hindrance of mind is like being, it's like being born to that child. And a child, when we look at little children dancing and being so free, they haven't yet formed all that self-consciousness that then begins to prevent us from meeting our true expression of ourselves.
Yeah, all the groovy stuff gets socialized out of us very quickly, doesn't it? So fast. That's why we sing and dance here, just to remind ourselves that that's the natural way to be, singing and dancing. But Vivian is the personification of this idea, because I've had the chance to see her paintings, and she can make the most extraordinary things happen in a tiny little space. She, do you mind if I mention, she hurt her arm, so she's gone from large canvases to tiny little blocks, 3 inches square. And they're layered upon layer upon layer. And the more you look, the deeper you fall into what she's done. I wish you all a wonderful week, filled with discovery of the miracle of every moment around us, that Krishna is with us at every second, in every detail. There's a verse in the Sanskrit Brahma Samhita that says, Andantarastam paramanu chayantarastam govindamari purusham tamaham bhajami. That Krishna is within the atom and he is between the atoms. So the biggest of the big and the smallest of the small. May you go forth from this place with that sense of the large and the small, all factoring into that wonderful mystery of life. Please.
We accept donations.
Michael is our CFO here, so he gets.
We've been breaking down and closing out later than normal because people haven't put their stuff away. So if everybody can put the pizzas in this box when they're done, pulses over here, and blocks over here, and blankets over here, because we have the rest of the stuff to break down, and we'd like to get home because we have to get up in the morning also. So it would help us.
Yes, and I apologize for ending late. Sometimes you get a little enthusiastic. Yes?
Is there something like a little neat and special that you're going to be doing this Sunday you want to share with us?
Well, golly, Cher. this Sunday at B.B. King on 42nd Street and 8th Avenue, I have the great privilege and fun of playing with the Alan Parsons Band doing a tribute concert to George Harrison. I think it starts 8 o'clock, I believe.
I think it's
7:30. Thank you, 7:30. And those of you who utterly don't care about the Oscars are welcome to come. It's just a lot of fun. We've done the George tribute show here at Jiva Mukti in years gone by. And so there you go.
You should not miss it. This band knows.
Yeah, they're really a wonderful band.
I mean, they know every single George song.
Yeah, these people are great.
George songs from, I mean, they're incredible. You close your eyes and you actually can hear George sing.
It's a wonderful, wonderful band. So as
they
is.
They all sing.
Well, I don't. I play tambourine because I can't sing. Three of them sing. So our protocol here is that we end as we start with three repetitions of the Om Mantra. So if you would join me. As always, for your friendship, for your wonderful contributions, questions, interest in Bhagavad Gita, and see you all next week, I hope. Hare Krishna.
All glories to you, Shri Krishna.
Shri Krishna. Bye. Bye. This gentleman, here's his name is here.
Thank you.
Yeah.